here we go. All right, I wanted to start today by reading from the September 23rd devotional in the devotional called Jesus Calling, and it's by Sarah Young. Yeah, it's really wonderful. You can get it online. It's as an app, or it's just a beautiful little book, too. Walk with me in the freedom of forgiveness. The path we follow together is sometimes steep and slippery. If you carry a burden of guilt on your back, you're more likely to stumble and fall. At your request, I will remove the heavy load from you and bury it at the foot of the cross. When I unburden you, you are undeniably free. Stand up straight and tall in my presence so that no one can place more burdens on your back. Can you see that? Stand up straight and tall in my presence so no one can put more burdens on your back. I think that's beautiful. Look into my face and feel the warmth of my love light shining upon you. It is this unconditional love that frees you from both fears and sins. Spend time basking in the light of my presence. As you come to know me more and more intimately, you grow increasingly free. That was so beautiful and had a lot to do with what we're going to talk about today. The devotional then goes on to refer us to 1 John chapter 4, verse 18, and it is this. Such love has no fear, but perfect love expels all fear. If we are afraid, it is for fear of punishment, and this shows that we have not fully experienced his perfect love. So today I'm going to toss out this hypothesis that Saul of Tarsus, just so there's no confusion, Saul of Tarsus started out as Saul of Tarsus. He then became Paul, who then became our present day, or still is our present day, Satan. I'm going to be using Saul and Paul interchangeably, but it's all the same guy. Okay, so here's my hypothesis, that before his conversion, I think he was afraid. I think he was a very fearful human being. And like many of us, we're afraid of change. We're afraid of upsetting the status quo. And Saul had a whole lot to lose, because he was a very respected Pharisee. He had power, he had respect, and if this whole Christianity thing caught on, he was gonna lose that, and he knew it. Much like the other Pharisees and the Sadducees who had previously murdered Jesus. There was a whole lot of power that was going to be lost if anyone could speak to God directly. So let's take a look at a quote from C.S. Lewis, and this is from the book The Four Loves. Here he wrote, "To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything and your heart will be wrung and possibly broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in a casket or a coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe and dark, motionless, airless, your heart will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, unpenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable."
Big Jen Buck could not bear.
Sorry.
Okay, so my sons, Scotty and Jack, I talk about them regularly, and God forbid they ever listen to these podcasts because I'm a little embarrassed. But so when they were little guys, we had pets of every kind. You can imagine chinchilla, frogs, dogs, cats. What else? We had a snake at one point. We had a baby squirrel. We took care of a baby bunny. All sorts of animals. So, but there was a whole lot of pet drama. When you have a lot of animals, you fall in love with them, you are really opening up your heart to be vulnerable. So, quick story. They had all sorts of frogs at one point. Every kind of frog you can imagine. They rescued toads, they rescued big honking frogs, crazy frogs. And so when, sooner or later, they kind of all get super stinky and die. And we had one left, and his name was Fru. And we were going on this 2-week vacation, as you can imagine, we couldn't find anyone to frog sit. So we had to bring this frog fruit to Nantucket with us for 2 weeks. Well, I didn't realize it, but Nantucket doesn't have crickets. And this is what Fru's had a steady diet of crickets. So we were out every day digging up roly-polies, and we were looking for anything that this poor frog could eat. And the boys started getting more and more concerned that Fru wasn't going to make it because, you know, he didn't have any crickets. So guess who called Boston to have a box load of crickets flown to Nantucket? So as fate would have it, Nantucket crickets, or Massachusetts crickets, apparently are quite a bit larger than Maryland crickets, and Fru promptly choked on one of them and died. So we had a pet funeral. All right, so next there was Hamsty. Hamsty the hamster. I wasn't the one naming the animals, by the way. Hamsty was in one of those balls, you know, the exercise balls, huge, round, clear things. And I think I was the one who did it. But the three of us were standing there, and I put Hamsty in his ball on the bedside table. What was I thinking? Because he rolled off and bounced and then was laying there like this. He had everything but X's across his eyes. And the boys and I were standing there totally shocked looking at him. And we picked up the ball, and the boy said, "Oh no." And all of a sudden, Hamsty stood up and was fine. Apparently, hamsters can get concussions and can be unconscious. more pet drama. Right, the third one that happened, as luck and life would have it, our dog passed away 3 days later while having just a regular run-of-the-mill surgery. And so as I picked the boys up from school that day, I explained, well, you know, the dog passed away and blah, blah, blah. And Jack, I'm not going to say that because he may listen to this sometime.
Super soft-hearted.
Screamed, "No more pets!" Because he was heartbroken. Too much drama. And just like C.S. Lewis had said, the boys had become vulnerable. They'd become hurt because they loved. And to open up and feel that beautiful love is such a gift that we've been given, but it's scary, right? So when Billy and I were in premarital counseling, our pastor had said to us, if neither of you become vulnerable, you're going to be fine, but your marriage will not be strong because either of you could tip over in the wind at any time. But if both of you become vulnerable and lean into each other, then you create this very strong structure and your marriage will last. But if only one of you becomes vulnerable, the marriage will collapse. And so when I'm thinking about vulnerability, it does mean that you have to lean in to be able to experience everything that the Lord has for us in relationship. And we were built for a relationship. I think that Saul of Tarsus probably had a problem with vulnerability. That's just a guess. Rather than seeing life through a lens of love and experiencing life from a position of love, I think he experienced it from a position of fear, a fear of losing everything that we talked about a minute ago. And if you go back over your own life and take a look at different seasons of your life and different decisions that you've made, you can probably trace back to times where you made decisions from a position of fear or through a lens of fear. And there are very different outcomes when that happens. And I would pray for you guys that you spend most of your life living in a position of love because it brings God's calm to you because God is love. Remember that? He is love. So do you think Saul had a dog? I seriously doubt it, but he might have. We know almost nothing about Saul's childhood, but let's talk quickly about what he did know, what we do know. So he'd been a Pharisee, as we've mentioned. He was a member of one of the strictest Jewish sects that you could be a member of. It was all about ceremonies, laws, strict doctrine, not a whole lot of learning about God's love and about grace, not a whole lot about faithfulness, God's faithfulness to us, but very much about the Pharisee system of belief. It was a real religious point of view. So he considered himself the most zealous, most religious, and most careful of all Pharisees. In Acts 13:6, Paul says, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. So this means, what that tells us is he grew up under a very strict household, very legalistic, very influenced by his father, who was strict and conscientious and followed the letter of the law. Not bad, not good, that's just who he was, it's how it went for his family. So a Pharisee was a man who was deeply religious. He was a firm believer in God, no doubt about that. He was a stern advocate of the authority of law and as well as government. And he claimed to have very strict moral footings, a very strict moral code. They were thought of as being bigoted and attached to their own opinions and attached to the traditions of their fathers. Saul grew up in Tarsus, which was a bustling city. It was a great city. And the Greek geographer Strabo said that when it came to philosophy and general education, Tarsus was greater even than Athens and Alexandria. And it was the crossroads of where the East meets the West. Tarsus was the home of a major Gentile community, which means that Greek was spoken there by a very large group of the population. And it also had a very large Jewish colony. His family lived there for generations, and we know that because to have been a Roman citizen, which he was, and he mentions later on that he didn't buy that position, it means that his family was granted that honor, basically, and it probably had happened a number of generations prior to his birth. Okay. He spoke Aramaic, Hebrew, Greek, and most likely Latin, because he was very well educated. And it was because Tarsus was this huge cosmopolitan city where people of all different languages came, and again, because he was so well learned. Especially Greek, I want you to hold on to that, because it was, again, the language of the Gentiles. And since he lived with those Gentiles, he was aware of their culture, he was comfortable with their culture, and they were probably comfortable with his comfort. He, as I said, was very well educated. He studied under a guy named Rabbi Gamaliel, which means nothing to us, but at the time he was a very, very well respected teacher. He says he himself sat at the foot of Gamaliel, which is just like when you heard Mary and Martha talking about Jesus. Remember, Martha, Martha, chill out and have a seat at my feet. What Mary was a disciple of Jesus. So sitting at the feet of a rabbi, so Mary sat at the feet of Rabbi Jesus, Saul sat at the feet of Rabbi Gamaliel, so he was a disciple. Lightning round of fun facts. Are you ready? Paul was vertically challenged. He was not a man of impressive size, and tradition has it that he was bald-headed, bold-legged, and short but strongly built, and had a unibrow that met over a very large nose. So, he first appears in the Bible in Acts 7, 57 through 60, during the stoning of Stephen. Just a tiny mention of him. Here's what happened. They put their hands over their ears and began shouting. They rushed at Stephen and dragged him out of the city and began to stone him. His accusers took off their coats and laid them at the feet of a young man named Saul. They stoned him. Stephen prayed, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit. And he fell to his knees, shouting, Lord, don't charge them with this sin. And with that, he died. Saul was one of the witnesses, and he agreed completely with the killing of Stephen. He was one of the witnesses. They laid their coats at his feet, so they knew him and they trusted him, and yet he did not pick up a stone. He was willing to stand there and watch it happen, but he didn't have the crazy, wacky courage, whatever it was, this mob mentality to pick up the stone and throw it to kill Stephen. Paul then goes on to become somewhat of a terrorist. He's known as one who hated Christians. He went about seeking them and eliminating those individuals, and he generally considered them to be breaking Jewish law. He had a strong hatred for Jesus and all that Jesus stands for. So let's read about it in Acts 8, 1 through 3. A great wave of persecution. This is right at the next line. So we heard the last line was And he agreed completely with killing Stephen. The next line is, a great wave of persecution began the day of Stephen's stoning, sweeping over the church of Jerusalem. And all the believers, except the apostles, were scattered through the regions of Judea and Samaria. Some devout men came and buried Stephen with great mourning. But Saul was going everywhere to destroy the church. He went from house to house, dragging out both men and women to throw them into prison. Okay, so why on earth would God choose this man to become the greatest missionary of all time? Why? There were plenty of other people who would have been willing to die for Jesus Christ and to show others that Jesus was willing to die for them during this early period of the church. But Jesus picked Saul, and he said it very clearly when he said, this man is a chosen instrument of mine to carry my name before the Gentiles, the kings, and the Israelites. That was Acts 9:15. I chose him. He's my chosen instrument to carry my name before the Gentiles. To do this, Jesus, to get Saul to do this, Jesus just had to get him to sit down and be quiet and listen. Because what happened at the time, Sadducees, Pharisees, do you remember how they used to question Jesus in the temple? Well, what about this? And Jesus would blow them away every time. Okay, they'd huddle back together again. What should we ask him next? Well, what about this? And they'd try to trap him. But every time, of course, Jesus had an answer that shut them down. This is who Saul was. And Saul just needed to be quiet, to listen. And what Jesus did was literally knock him off his horse and blind him so that he had to sit there and listen. He could no longer see. He could no longer do for himself. And I don't know if you remember in Acts when he does get to, after they take him into Damascus, he sits for 2 days not eating, not drinking. Can you imagine what was going on in his mind? Just the chaos that must have been going on. Have I been wrong all this time? What? And is he going to kill me? He was so afraid. All right, so I tell you from personal experience that if God wants you to do something, to be someone, or to see things differently, you will know that it's God, because he's going to do it in a way that is undeniably God. He will knock you off your horse and blind you, if that's what it takes. So, this is what he did. Saul of Tarsus was probably better than any of the original apostles to speak about freedom and the freedom that comes with truly knowing the answer to the question, what can I do to be saved? Because Saul had spent years teaching what you can do to be saved. You can follow this rule. You can do this thing. You can act in a certain way. You can not break the laws. You can. And what Jesus said is, no, you can't. You can't change anything. God already gave you grace. You already have grace. You can't earn grace. You already have it. And I think that because Saul was so steeped in the doing and the performing to earn this grace, he was the one who was completely set free from this and would be so easily able to explain this to people around him. So I think that's an amazing idea why he was chosen, and so chosen just beautifully. In, bless you, in the book Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis wrote this, for mere improvements is not redemption. Through redemption, though redemption always improves people, but only to a degree we cannot yet imagine. God became man to turn creatures into sons, not simply to produce better men of the old kind, but to produce a new kind of man. It's not like teaching a horse to jump better and better. It's like turning a horse into a winged creature. Does that make sense? So Saul and those who were following the laws that were set forth for the Jews at that time were trying to become better and better and better. They're trying to become better jumpers, better horse jumpers. They were trying to just be better. And God says, no, 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 no. You don't have to be better. Come to me. I want to turn you into a creature that can fly over those jumps, so much greater than you can ever imagine. And I believe that God wanted more for Saul than Saul was living, more for his life than what he was living. He wanted to soften Saul's heart so that he could experience this crazy, radical, ever-enduring love that God had for him. And then he wanted Saul to be able to spread this love across the world, across generations, in person as well as in his writings, that we today learn so much about Jesus Christ. So with Paul's conversion, he now knew that earning grace and having to work for salvation was false. It was a lie. Yeah. He, of course, went on to teach the generations that that is a lie. Okay, so he was also chosen, again, as we said, because he spoke Greek and was so comfortable with that and familiar with the culture, that he was able to live in that culture comfortably and teach those folks. He was a shining example of anyone, even the very most hard-hearted, unbeliever, the vilest of murderers, or one simply living in fear. He was a beautiful example of becoming this new creature when he allowed God into his life. He allowed Jesus to quiet him down and to learn about Jesus' word and to learn about the love. We are promised in Ezekiel 36:26, and I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit in you. I will take out your stubborn, stony heart and give you a tender, responsive heart. Saul, stubborn, stony. Jack and Scotty, soft and tender. Huge difference. If God chose Saul of Tarsus, then why wouldn't he choose someone like us? Right? He was a murderer. He was a terrorist. And God was able to change his stony heart. So we have stony places in our hearts. He so easily could change ours, even more easily, way more easily than he changed Saul of Tarsus' heart. Great change happens incrementally, though. Small, little changes add up to big changes. So you and I may never travel from country to country. How wonderful would that be? But you and I may never be able to do that, travel from country to country, changing people's lives, starting a church, starting the Catholic, the Christian church. We may never be able to do that, but what we can do is teach our children to love those around us. We can fold our husband's laundry with love in our hearts. We can go to work every day and smile at the people whom we serve. We can do tiny little things to service the kingdom and to grow the kingdom in our way. Because again, change is incremental. Tiny little changes add up to enormous changes. In Matthew 12:48-50, Jesus says, "Who is my mother and who are my brothers?" And stretching out his hand toward his disciples, he said, "Here are my mothers and my brothers and my sisters. Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother." He didn't have tiny T-Rex arms. He had everlasting, ever-reaching arms. Here are my brothers and sisters and mothers. I spotted a really interesting line. One of the books that Betsy recommended we take a look at on our reading list that she gave us last week is called Paul, A Servant of Jesus Christ. It's by F.B. Meyer, and it's a little bit old Englishy, so you're gonna have to forgive me, I'm kind of paraphrasing here. Okay, so here's what F.B. Meyer said about God choosing Paul. "But as God looked with his all-knowing, his omniscient and loving eye down through the ages, his gaze must have landed with particular pleasure on the eager and devoted soul of Paul." Okay, so he's saying, here's God, it's before time. He's looking down the ages with his loving eye at all of the souls who are to come, and he alights on Paul. That's what he's talking about here.
Can I ask a question? question?
Yes, please.
When did Paul have this conversion? I know that last week Betsy said that he wrote Colossians in A.D. 61.
Right.
But when did he have this conversion?
It was somewhere between A.D. 30 and A.D. 36. Well, it wouldn't have been A.D. 30 because that Jesus was still alive. So it would have been A.D. 33 to A.D. 36-ish, right in that
After
time.
Jesus died.
Yes. Yeah. And then he spent a few years with the apostles learning about Christ and living that life, and so that he was confident to spread the word. Oh, I don't know if you guys on the podcast heard that. The question was, when did all of this happen? Approximately what year did Saul's conversion happen? Okay, so back to what F.B. Meyer said. Oh, let's see. He looked with pleasure on the eager and devoted soul of Paul. God knew Saul of Tarsus before time itself. God had a purpose, and knowing Paul's capacity for the best, selected him for the special purpose of spreading the good news of the Lord to the Gentiles. And Meyer goes on to say, I'm sure that there must have been signs of holy rapture on Paul's face when he realized this. And when he wrote it from his prison cell to the Ephesians, Paul said, all praise to God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who has blessed us with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly realms, because we are united with Christ. Even before he made the world, God loved us and showed us in Christ to be holy and without fault in his eyes. Can you imagine someone who had been a terrorist, someone who had drugged people out of their homes because he didn't believe in their belief system, who had killed people, who had ordered people killed, who had imprisoned wives and daughters and sisters and mothers, and having realized that God knew him and loved him before time began? I can't imagine, because we all carry guilt. I'm a Christian woman who married a Jewish man. I'm really good at accepting guilt. He's really good at giving guilt. Perfect match. He then has converted to Christianity. But still, I carry a ton of guilt. I've never killed anyone. I've never drug anyone out of their home. Is that a word, drug, dragged? I don't know.
Dragged.
I've never dragged anyone out of their home. But Paul did, and he carried this enormous weight on his back. And you remember from the devotional when the author said, stand tall in the throne of God. Don't let anyone put any more weight on you. Don't let anyone heap any more guilt onto your back. You're free. And this is what Paul must have been experiencing. It's just amazing. I mean, when I experience it, it's amazing. All right, completely lost my place here. Okay, here we go. All right. So this is the point of his life. Paul knew through and through that Christ was truly his brother. Truly his brother. And that he had been chosen long before he was the twinkle in his mother's eye. That he was completely forgiven, unburdened of guilt, and without fault in God's eyes. Clean. Perfectly clean. I understand why F.B. Meyer wrote that his face must have been so full of this holy rapture. Okay, so
whose bag is that?
Want to grab that? So there are so many of us, myself included, who live our lives through and into a story that someone else has written for us. Paul lived his life into this story that his father and his father before him had written for him, had written this story, this life, for him to live out. But it had nothing to do with the story that God had written for him and the life that God had wanted for him. So when you're living in this lie, it changes the way you see the world, it changes your decision, it changes your path, and the Lord is there wanting to step in and say, no, just step into the life that I have for you. So for instance, for me, silly thing, but it affected me. Fifth grade, Mr. Lombardo. says to me, Parents' Day, parents' visiting day at school. I asked a question in front of all the parents, and he said, that is a stupid question.
Oh, my God.
You should know the answer to that.
As a teacher?
And you can guess that I almost never asked another question again in school. Because I ask stupid questions, and I'm no good at math. And I lived that until, honestly, fairly recently. And so I had stepped into this story, this lie that Mr. Lombardo, probably not knowing what he was doing, wrote for me. And the Lord finally smacked me in the head and said, no, that is not the life I have for you. You ask questions. You be Thomas. Thomas said, I'm not going to believe it until I see it. And Jesus said, all right, Thomas, good for you. Come, come closer. Ask me questions. Put your hand in my side. Look at my palms. Come closer and ask. Every question we ask draws us closer to Jesus Christ. So ask. Wonder. Doubt your doubts. Wonder. That's the life, part of one of the stories of life that the Lord had for me, and he has for you. So what we have to do sometimes, particularly as women, is sort out, whose story am I living here? Am I who some mean grandmother said I was? Am I who some boyfriend who broke up with me said I was? No. You are the daughter of the King Most High. You are Jesus Christ's sister, and not his little sister who's annoying. You're his sister whom he loves to spend time with. He loves you. That's the story. So sort through some of those lies in your mind, and freedom awaits. Okay. He'd been living this lie, Saul had. He understood now that he was redeemed and set free. And because Saul realized this, he moved from being Saul to Saint Paul. How's that? Changed the world. Absolute and total redemption. That's what this story is about. And there are stories after stories in the Bible of redemption everywhere you look, because that's what God does. That's what God does. So last week I was with a young friend of mine. We went to Annapolis. She'd never seen Annapolis before, so I took her there to kind of wander around and see the town. And there's a little teeny museum there that talks about slavery. And it talks about how some of the folks at the time who became slaves or indentured servants had to do so because they owed a debt to someone. So what they would do is sell themselves to someone who would buy them. They'd take that money and pay off their debt. And now they had to be this servant. They had to work for this person, indentured, not paid, like a slave, until they were able to work off their debt to this person. And as this friend of mine and I were walking around, I realized, wow, that is the most beautiful description of redemption right there. And I said to her, that's what redemption is. I was having difficulty explaining to her what exactly is that. And that was a beautiful example of it right there. It's exactly what happened. Jesus died to pay our debt, and so that we could be free from being an indentured servant, so that we could speak directly to God anytime we wanted to, so that we could repair this relationship with God. Redemption in the dictionary is defined this way: the act of regaining possession of something in exchange for payment or the clearing of a debt. It's the action of saving or being saved from sin, error, or evil. Here's another really cool explanation of redemption that I shared with some of you guys last year. How many of you know about the Alpha Course? So many of you do. I go to a church in Virginia, just over the district line, just over the bridge, called HTC. It's Holy Trinity Church, and they run the Alpha Course regularly, and we've got one starting this Thursday, if anyone's interested. Billy and I are leading one of the small groups, my husband and I. It's a wonderful course, and it answers the hard questions of life. Why did Jesus have to die? What happens when we're praying really hard and someone dies anyway? Why is there evil in the world? It answers all of these questions. And it has this wonderful explanation for redemption, illustration of it. And here it is. So there were once two little boys who were best friends. They did everything together. They played together. They dreamed together. They went to school together. And then they even went to college together. They were absolutely inseparable until their careers took them in very different directions. One friend became an attorney, and the other friend became a criminal. The attorney, through the years later, was promoted to a judge, and the criminal went further and further into the criminal life until finally he was arrested one day and was brought into court where his best friend is sitting as the judge. And the judge had this horrible dilemma. I have to do the right thing. He has to pay his penalty for doing this horrible thing. And so he sentenced his friend to a fine that he knew his friend could never ever pay himself. And what the judge did then was to take off his robes and walk down in front of the bench and stand with his friend and write a check and paid the fine. And that is what Jesus did for us. Sin is death, and we couldn't be with God if we were sinners. And he sent his son, he came here himself, to write the check himself and to die for us. That is the redemption that we all have experienced. His grace is bigger than any question or any doubt that you might have. It's bigger than any fear you might have. And it's big enough to cover your faults, your sins, your thoughts, whatever it is, whatever guilt you're holding on to, he is greater. His grace is greater than all of it. If he fully redeems Saul of Tarsus, of course he will fully redeem you and me. Of course he will. He saw us when he was looking down the line of all of the souls all through time. He saw you and he saw me. And he knew who we were from the very beginning and loved us. We just have to accept that and live into that life rather than to the life that we've been lied to about. All right, I wanted to close, Catherine, if this is okay with you, by listening to a song that speaks really beautifully to the words that Paul himself could have spoken. It's called Reckless Love, and it's by Corey Asbury. And what I'm going to do is hand out, once we listen to this, I'm going to hand out the words. And when you go to your small group, what I'd love for you to do is to discuss this song. That's what your questions today would be. Spend time discussing this song. What did he mean? How does it relate to Saul, and how does this relate to me today? Okay? So small group leaders, could you raise your hands? All right. Sharon, where are you? Where's your small group?
We're in this little den over here.
The den, okay. And where are you guys?
Living room.
In the living room.
Sunroom.
Sunroom, and then I'm here in this living room. Okay? All right, so let's just take a listen. A beautiful sound. You were. Oh, it's a beautiful song. I'm getting it hooked up here. Should we just play it out of loud, lousy quality?
Well, if I can. I need to turn on the.
Sorry for the dead air here.
Box is in pairing mode, waiting for device to connect.
That sounds hopeful.
Sing along if you want to.
Shall
we just take
it to
my
Before I took a breath, you breathed your life in me. You have been so, so kind to me.
Your small groups now and discuss.
Thank you.